Hi there, Lorena Allam here with you, and on Hindsight today, the sound of photography. It's a program which weaves together three photographic collections from three continents. The first collection is by an artist in the USA, Steve Roden, who finds his photographs in junk shops. The second is UK-based historian Elizabeth Edwards, who specialises in survey photographs. And the third collection comes from New South Wales State Records, where Debbie Evans and Susan Charlton have been searching through photographs taken by the Aborigines Welfare Board. In their search, each collector discovers for themselves what a photograph can do, how it creates meaning, and how it belongs to a conversation beyond its frame. Lynn Gallagher is our guide to the darkroom today. This recording, with all its wonkiness and hiss, was never meant for public broadcast. It was made at home on paper with a thin plastic covering on the top to protect it. It wasn't supposed to be a record that went out into the world. It's remarkable now because of its unremarkableness. And this has much to say about photography and the way it develops. But to understand why, we need a dark room. Fortunately, RMIT in Melbourne's CBD has one. And they also have a darkroom expert.
My name is Alex Sinicus, and I coordinate a few of the courses here in historical photographic processes. But what we're going to be doing now is going across Swanston Street to Building 8. We're going to go to the 7th level, and we'll go and have a look at the darkroom.
Now we're not about to get run over by a tram.
Yeah, we'll just go quickly across.
It's a journey back in time to get to this dark room because there's not too many of them left.
Whoops, here we go. Go to level 7. Welcome to 19th century.
Wow.
You can smell the chemistry, you can smell developer and fixer and things like that, which unfortunately students of today don't experience, because they experience computers and heat and it's inkjet printers, and they miss on this magic, and there is a magic here.
For Alex, going backwards helps him decide what to project forwards. It gives his process a layer of meaning beyond the mere subject matter.
I'm just going to mix up some chemistry. So we'll put some chemistry here. So we're going to start with a developer. And I'm just going to mix this up 1 to 4. Now, I'm just going to do for today just a quick developer, what we call the multi-grade Ilfabrom. I'm just mixing it here.
This program is about what happens to a photograph after the shutter has been clicked. What sort of life does it have? What sound does it make? And how do these sounds shape our history?
I'm interested in what photographs do rather than what they're of. And what they're of is, yeah, it's important, but it's what they do, what people do with them, what they expect them to do.
Elizabeth Edwards, the author of The Camera as Historian. It's a book about British amateur photographers who around the turn of the century took ordinary pictures of the world around them. They were part of a survey movement, and their aim was to record ancient buildings, folk customs, old churches, cottages, manor houses, and even remarkable trees, in order to build a national memory bank. The images were carefully catalogued and stored in a publicly accessible collection.
It's a coming together of all sorts of different cultural trends and strands which make photography as a tool of history thinkable for a very wide range of people. And so I think, you know, we need to position it in those terms first. And then the rules of the survey movement were or the various survey groups that made up the survey movement, was actually about controlling the way people photographed. It was, if you like, orchestrating their vision with an archival end. And so many of the survey groups issued lists of what they would like photographed. These are really interesting because they give us an idea of what people valued about in their historical environment. What was important for them? Who created a certain kind of identity for them?
The ambition behind the survey movement was to gather a complete picture of everything. At the time, it was thought that everything could be photographed and everything could be archived. It didn't work.
Froggy went a-courtin' and he did ride. Froggy went a-courtin' and he did ride a sword and pistol by his side.
These sounds are from a photography book called I Listen to the Wind Obliterate My Traces. It's an unusual book because it comes with a set of recordings. And the link between the sounds and the pictures is tangential, except for the fact that the pictures have people in them who are pictured alongside things that make sound. Instruments, gramophones, radio wax cylinders, glass harmonicas, Bakelite records, barrel organs, tuning forks and tambourines. Artist Steve Roden found these images in flea markets.
A little piece of cornbread laying on the shelf. If you want any more, you can sing it to yourself.
I like things that don't really have much value to other people. And you build value between your conversation, between yourself and the object or the image or the sound or whatever it is. And when you don't know anything about something, I think you tend to have less assumptions.
It's the conversation with an object, Steve says, that can help mend your insides.
Oh, bury me not on a lone prairie. These words came long and mournfully.
They do help mend your insides. You can return to them and they don't change. I mean, their effect on you changes because, again, your relationship with them is continually growing, but they heal things for you. You know, certain songs like Oh, Bury Me Not on the Lone Prairie, the way that his voice trembles and the way that the strings come in, and there's such a slow plodding pace to that sound. And
his loved ones
the whole thing is delicate, as if it might fall apart. And every once in a while, I listen to it, and I just have to let go of everything because it fills me up, you know.
And is it the same with photographs?
Yeah, there are certain images. I mean, it's funny. There's the one image of a family, and it's a photo postcard, and somebody smeared across the middle of the photograph this disgusting green color. I don't know if somebody spilled ink on it or it was thrown in the trash, or I don't know what happened to it, but all of the handling and all of the things that have happened to it in its lifetime offer this kind of wonderful, again, sense of tactility and emotion and movement and alchemy, and it's like I pull it out, I look at it, and it offers me just this enormous conversation when I felt as if there was nothing else for me to say.
A lot of photographic theory has focused on the camera as a metaphor and the lens as a metaphor. And there's too much consideration about what happens at that moment of exposure, which is certainly part of the argument. But I think equally important is what happens after that That sort of temporal lapse, the film or the plate comes out of the camera, it's developed, and then it goes into a family album, or it goes into a survey movement exhibition, or whatever happens to it. It's at that point the product of photography becomes part of the connective tissue of society. And it has done this since at least the 1850s. I mean, one could argue a little bit earlier, but it becomes mass from the 1850s.
For me, my first experience with this was when I was a child. I think I was about 9. And I remember back in my days, I used to watch Disneyland on TV. And I always remember there was a Kodak commercial where these groups of young kids bought one of these kits, developing kits. So it had a light, it had trays, it had everything. Then they went into this little tent and they developed a print. And when I saw that, to me, I thought, wow, this is amazing. There's a piece of white paper under safe light, under an orange light, and then by just exposing it and then putting it into a solution, you get this beautiful image that comes up. So that sort of sold me. And every time I develop a print, I turn off the lights and I'm here on my own in this room, I always feel, wow, you know, I'm tracing back my childhood, my journey through all these years, my learning from the great masters like Caponegro, Weston, Ansel Adams. And I was very fortunate to get hold of some video clips. And it's actually, you see Ansel Adams developing a print. And in those days, even developing a film, the way he used to check to see whether the print was developed properly was, believe it or not, he had a cigarette in his mouth, and by taking a puff, that low glow of the cigarette was enough to light up, because it was sort of an orangey, greeny light, was enough to be able to see the progression of the development of the film.
He could have killed himself.
And a lot of them did. But, you know, this is the price you pay, I guess, you know, for this. But that was how they lived. They lived by that. That was their mark in life. I'm now going to make a solution of stop bath, because that's the whole idea, is that we develop the print on paper, the image on paper, but when it goes actually into the developer, that then reduces into black silver, so we can then see the image, and then we have to put it through a couple of other processes like the stop bath to stop the alkalinity of the developer, and then we put it into fixer to remove any unexposed silver halide. Okay. And then we can turn on the lights. So I'm just going to turn off the white light. So isn't this wonderful? Look at this light. It's this beautiful orange light, this peace, and you feel that the surroundings is breathing around you. History is all around you.
One of the early problems with photography was finding a fixer. The developing fluid would expose the image, but then keep on developing until the paper turned black. So a fixer, this tray of fluid here, needed to be found. But no one's ever discovered a fixer for meaning, and images still go on and will go on developing. Elizabeth Edwards took the name of her book, The Camera as Historian, from a 1916 publication, a small handbook written by 3 members of the Surrey Survey Movement, which set out detailed methods for the use of photography in the recording of the past. It claimed that photography was superior to all other forms of graphic record and showed how the camera could fix history and how anyone could do it. But what impressed Elizabeth Edwards more than that was that
The book showed a rise in the popularity of photography that went hand in hand with a rethinking of history.
There is a reappraisal of what history is about. It's no longer just about kings and queens and politicians and battles and wars and state papers. I think it's a moment of archival expansion. And I think the survey movement is very much tied up with a concept of archival expansion into the record of the everyday. Now, it may not be the state archives that are collecting this kind of material at that time, but I think local archives most certainly are. And this is why I think there's this very interesting tie-up between the survey movement and local libraries, local studies libraries and archives, although they weren't really using the word archive of it at that stage. Local studies libraries and museums. And I think it's all part of an expansion of the idea of what history is and indeed what memory is. You've got to remember people like, you know, the French writer Henri Bergson was really rethinking what it was to remember. And, you know, he's talking about memory being embodied and memory being about the everyday and not about, you know, conventional big H history anymore.
So are you convinced that the camera is an historian?
Yes, I think everybody uses the camera to form some sort of historical narrative, particularly analogue photography. I think things are changing in very interesting ways now in the way that people use images in a digital environment. But in an analogue environment, I think most photography was made within families, within groups, within the survey movement, as a form of anticipated memory. Therefore, it is always about an anticipating a future that was going to want to look back on its past, whether it's within the family, whether it's in the community, in the library, the museum, or wherever. And so I think you could say, yes, the camera was always a historian of some sort. And at the very earliest days of photography, when the medium was first announced in Europe, you know, this idea that it could record for the future was absolutely central to, if you like, the cultural conception of what this machine could do.
Our Redeemer is building grand mansions above for the saved of all nations, we're told. The morning he'll call us to wonderful love, to the beautiful mansion of gold. Oh, the beautiful mansion of gold, half the beauty has never been told. We shall live there someday with a Savior for it.
Right now, we're in our Skylight studio. This is a studio that any 19th century photographer would love to work in. It's a beautiful light. It's consistent all day long. Generally, in a 19th century studio, what you're looking for is what the artists look for as well. For the sitter to come to a photographic studio, the experience was one of wonder. To climb up three flights of stairs, you're out of breath. You're not sure what's going to be in the studio. They sit you down in a chair, they bring a cast iron headstand to keep your head steady, and they wheel a camera like this up to your face. It's like a cannon being aimed at you. And then you smell different smells. You have the smell of ether. You have the smell of alcohol, the smell of cyanide, the smell of oil of lavender. And all these things are mixed together in a gumbo that is completely unfamiliar to you. And then they say, try to have a natural expression.
Just grabbing the book.
How much did you pay for the photographs?
There's only one photograph that I paid a ton of money for because I just could not let it go.
Which one was that?
And it ended up not reproducing very well in the book because it's a tintype. It's a picture of, I think it's the first or second image in the book, but it's an image of a little boy holding a record. And I think it's probably the earliest photograph of a record, period. A flat round record. It's not in the introduction. I think it's when the book actually starts. Yeah, he's holding a little horn.
Ah.
But in his hand, he's got a brown sleeve with a black hole in it, in his other hand, and that's a record. And actually, it's, in a funny way, it's actually facing probably the second most expensive photograph I bought, which is much more important. It's an early image of a cylinder player, and you can see a series of rubber tubes coming off of the record player or the cylinder player. And those rubber tubes were meant for other people to stand around and listen to the recording. And you'd pay a penny, and, you know, 8 or 9 people could stand and listen to the song through these rubber headphones.
Some negatives here. These are some of my negatives. They're 4x5 inch, what we call 4x5 inch negatives. And as you can see there, they're in a sort of a envelope to protect them from getting scratched and things like that.
So there's a lot of flexibility that you have, a lot of control here.
Oh yes.
It's not just a simple machine process.
No. You can change the contrast again just by the way you agitate a tray of...
We're looking at trays.
So this is a tray, and just the agitation of the chemistry that's in there, the developer that's in the tray, will give you different levels of contrast as well. So this is the beauty of this. And there's a magic. You know, we're going back to the beginning of photography with people like Fox Talbot in UK, Joseph Niepce in France, and then Louis Daguerre, and then all the others that have taken on from there and developed it. And then you had different movements in photography, the photo secessionist, and then you moved into, you know, late 19th century, where you were also inspired by what was happening with the impressionist movement. So there was that whole thing of trying to make your photographs look like paintings in a way.
Do you think about who's going to see the photo as you make it?
Oh, yes. Very important.
In what way?
Well, obviously, the intention is that possibly this print will go on a wall in an exhibition. Others will see it. And they'll see it. They'll see the image. But they'll see it through the translation of the one who actually took the photo. Why was this photo taken? What is it trying to show? How is it shown? And possibly things like, you know, the contrasting, whether it's a really contrasty photo of it that creates an eerie feeling, or whether it's a very soft thing, soft romantic kind of quality to it. So the viewer, you know, will put judgment on this, and it comes up like that. So there it is.
I think one of the things that is absolutely clear is the enormous amount of low-level historical education that is going on through the medium of photography. in that photographic clubs have lectures, lantern slide lectures on, for instance, the great cathedrals of Britain or the great cathedrals of France, on half-timbered buildings, on Shakespeare, on all sorts of...
And there's one on beekeeping.
On beekeeping as well. Well, that's definitely self-improvement if you can keep bees.
And is that low-level history education part of a community of meaning? I mean, you're describing what goes on inside camera clubs, slide nights, when people go to libraries. When they talk about that sort of thing, is that what you mean about the sound of history?
Well, I think the sound of history is very much part of that community of meaning, in that you know, as people got together to talk about lantern slides and even display prints in exhibitions and talk about them. I think there are different communities of meaning that gather around a body of photographs, though. I mean, we see this in the recoding of archival collections across the world today. I mean, what started as anthropological collections are now family history. And so, you know, there is always all sorts of different communities of meaning coming to an archive, coming to a body of photographs and recoding them in the way that they want to consume them. And I think this is happening all the way through. It's certainly happening within the camera clubs, where you've got tensions between what photography is for. Is it to make records so everyone can understand history or zoology or anything else? Natural history is very popular as well. Or is it about an aesthetic practice? And I think there are major tensions that are, as different communities of meaning are putting claim to both photography and different styles of photography. And of course, these are very active and they're always changing. They're always refiguring around an archive and around a body of photographs. So, yes, I think there are communities of meaning and they come together in different ways at different moments. And I also think the sort of sociability of the lantern slideshow, the photographic excursion, or the trip to the library is actually part of this. Now, the sound of history, of course, is part of that, in that the first thing people do with photographs is start talking. Photography is about family. Photography is about place and home. And once photography starts operating in those sorts of environments, those communities of meaning, the voice, the human voice or human sound, because it's not even spoken words sometimes, it's what anthropologists call paralinguistic sound. It's the sighing and the weeping and the clicking of teeth, which are actually very redolent with meaning. And these all happen around and with photography. And most people, as I say, start talking. They start telling histories. They start talking about memory in ways that would not have been articulated had the photograph not been part of that conversation.
Here are the first Brownie cameras ever designed to take three different kinds of pictures.
To reduce the price of cameras and actually promote it, Eastman came out with something called the Brownie camera. This is from 1900.
The famous slogan which we all remember.
You press the button, we do the rest.
The Brownie turret is made by Kodak, so you know it's good.
My parents, my mother used to have a fold-out sort of box Brownie that was in her family, and they took photos, hundreds and hundreds of photos.
One good time
deserves another.
And you can double the fun of any day's outing
with a Brownie camera by Kodak.
Initially, it was intended to be a child's camera.
Just aim, focus, snap. It's as easy as that. Remember, only a Brownie camera gives you so much pleasure at so low a cost.
This is Hindsight on RN. I'm Lynn Gallagher, and you're listening to The Sound of Photography. The most controversial and complex photographs in our National Archive are those early images taken by government officials of Aboriginal people. Many of these photographs were taken in the racist belief that these images would be the last pictures ever taken of a disappearing race. But as much as anything, photographs are a social process. They're talked about, laughed over, and performed. And now, these images are being used to bring the dead back to life rather than bury them. Curator Susan Charlton remembers when she first saw some of these photographs.
The first time I saw the photographs was not long after I started work at the archives. My role was to create exhibitions and publications. And in that role, I met the Aboriginal archivist at the time, whose name was Kirsten Thorpe, and she had been working at the archives probably for about 8 years. She was a Warramai woman from New South Wales. And she showed me the photographs, and the beginning photos that you see in the collection are very beautiful. They're photographs of young Aboriginal women in studio portraits. And some of them look quite glamorous. They're wearing glamorous outfits, maybe even fur coats, holding handbags. They're sitting in these sets. And some of them are very beautiful photos of very beautiful women. And I think when I first saw that part of the collection, I thought, these women have had an okay life. Things have been okay for them. And little did I know that these women were, in fact, girls who were taken and sent to Cootamundra Girls' Home and trained to be servants. And these photos were taken by the board and used to promote the policies of having the homes and the girls working in this way. And then on closer inspection, you can see that probably a lot of these clothes might not have been the girls' clothes. And we certainly have heard at least one story of someone's mother who remembers going into the studio, being given a dress to put on and have a photo taken and then put that dress down for the next girl. So they're very complicated photos. And we sometimes think the board, they would never have imagined that these photos that they took and these other records that they wrote would go on and actually help people find each other and find out their history. They would never have imagined that. And possibly, if they had imagined that, they might have destroyed them.
Susan's referring to is the Aborigines Welfare Board, one of two organisations that controlled Aboriginal people's lives in New South Wales from 1880 to 1960. When the board closed down, their records became part of the New South Wales State Archive, and these records included 1,000 photographs. And when the photographs became an exhibition some years ago called In Living Memory, it was a total turnaround of the board's original aim in taking the photographs. For example, no photograph in the exhibition was displayed without permission from the family. Already this was a move that radically shifted this exhibition away from the old board's ideas of ownership and control. It also meant that Susan was not a curator, she was more of a consultant. Her job wasn't just to select images and hang them on a wall, but rather to talk to people. So In Living Memory became a team of consultants who worked with communities, who established an advisory group and who travelled out to country. When the exhibition travelled to Wagga Wagga, a local Indigenous host was invited to sit with the show while it was in town. Her name was Debbie Evans. So Debbie, you're saying all that talking is part of the process, that's
absolutely
part of the photo.
Absolutely, Lynn. It's the relationships you build up. It's the trust that you build. It's that people trust that you're going to treat such sensitive personal images. Remembering that a lot of these families would have grown up with no images of their grandmother, of their mothers. And so to finally find one tucked away in our government records and for that to be able to then get onto the wall in your family home and into your family photo album people are still so incredibly emotionally attached to the images. But there is that irony that this was government propaganda. This was justifying the assimilation and the past policies and practices of government. And now Aboriginal communities, through the team that Susan has spoken about, that put together this fantastic way, this methodology and way of working with community to build trust, to build relationships, knowing that they're actually going to do something and follow through and have, you know, act on what they say they're going to do. It's a really, really important process, and I'm as interested in the process as much as the outcome.
The outcome, however, was significant.
Precious memories,
we had busloads of people coming into Wagga. We had busloads of school children and elders on the same bus who travelled in from out at Condoblin, and people came from Murrumbridge and Albury and bought home care buses and bought just loads and loads of people. And the conversations in the exhibition space were fantastic. I don't think I've ever heard such a... They weren't quite exhibition spaces. There were lots of excitement as people were flicking through the albums and finding families and finding old photos of places that they love and they still live. So, you know, there's photos in there of the Brungal missions and the Murrumbridge missions and missions all over New South Wales. And as people are sharing stories and making all these... There's a whole web of connections and relationships and stories are just flowing across this museum exhibition space. That's when I became completely hooked and became a bit of a, you know, what we started to call ourselves In Living Memory junkies. I think we went to something like 8 different places with the In Living Memory team, including coming out here to Broken Hill and then taking the touring exhibition out to Menindee and Wilcannia, and we were so excited when we were in Wilcannia and some of the really old people came into the exhibition before it opened, and I said, are you right there, Unc? And one of the old uncles said, yeah, my girl, I'm just seeing whether or not it's worthwhile going home and getting the old girl and we'll come back and have a look. And that night, Lynn, we had 150 people that night for a community dinner, and they were still poring over photographs. And the other really important part about the community engaging with New South Wales State Records is that they're actually able to add a lot of names and identify a lot of people in the photographs. So remember that they were originally collected as part of the propaganda. A lot of the images don't have names on them. So there's two processes that happen with the exhibition. One is that if you can identify someone in that photograph, it's added into the database. And the other is that as part of the In Living Memory, when it was touring, people were actually able to order images and able to get copies of them, because we saw how it transformed people's lives. We saw how much it meant to people and helped them with their identity and helped them understand. So many people said, we now understand why Mum could never cuddle us.
In Living Memory visited 18 towns over 2 years, as well as some smaller places on the side. Added to this, communities are still booking the touring exhibition of the show for important occasions, and they're also using the photographs in the production of family photo books. Like its name, In Living Memory will not die.
I know that Sue Newman, who worked on the exhibition, she used to talk about the photos. They'd been taken out of their archive boxes and they weren't going to go back in again. And they were very powerful in themselves. Being in the exhibition space in the city, we felt connected to those people. And sometimes when we didn't know the answer to how to proceed, we would actually walk into the exhibition space and speak to the photographs and ask for advice. and invariably an answer to that question would present itself within days, if not by the time you walk back to your desk. So we definitely saw those photos, not just as an exhibition, but as a direct link back to a story and to people and to the future as well.
Do people want to touch the images?
Yes, and they, you know, they'd sit there, and I mean, you know, a lot of people would remember your grandmother sitting there and telling you a story, and there's an image there, and they pat them, and they would tell these fantastic stories because the images would trigger so many incredible memories. And one of the really important elders who came in, he knew a lot of the people, and his wife knew a lot of the people from the records because they had stuff from the old Menindee mission, and he told me who someone was in a photo. So I went back to Wagga and thought, oh, you know, this elder down there, she's a fantastic old Nyampa woman, and she and I thought, I know that's her first cousin. So I took this image back, and she's at the university where I work, and she's doing some printmaking, and about 10 to 2 in the afternoon she quietly looked up from her work, and I put this image in front of her and I said, there's your cousin there as a baby. And she said, looked up at me, and she said, that there is my mummy and daddy's wedding photo. She said, I've got a little tiny one at home. She said, and mummy's half cut off. She said, all my life I've been trying to get that there fixed. She said, this is the best day of my life.
We think of photos as mini portals in time. They offer us truth in a way that other forms of documentary evidence don't. Compare a birth certificate with a baby photo. Which one carries more weight? Which one really tells us who we were? Here's another track from Steve Roden's photography book. Try to listen to it without images forming in your head. Try to listen to it without photography.
Hello, everybody. Here's my favourite. The old grey horse come tearing out of the wilderness. Danced with a gal with a hole in a stocking, and a heel kept a rocking, and a heel kept a rocking. Most everyone east, west, north, and south knows the thrill of the old juice harp in your mouth. 'Tis an art to use it to get that fascinating twang. You remember the fun the old folks had as together we sang. Well, here's my favorite for my darling little Anne. It's Daddy doing the best I can.
I think it's very difficult for us to imagine now how the past looks when we don't have photography. It's actually the question I asked my first year undergraduate class. I said, you tell me, what does the Second World War look like with no photography? If you don't have those key images of conflict and Holocaust rattling around in your head, what can you know about it? And they look completely terrified and completely blank, because of course they cannot divest themselves of the images. And what I'm trying to get across to them is actually how so much of the last 150 years is actually constructed visually through photography. I mean, obviously there are visual representations of the past going way back, but it's that seductive realism and the idea of the trace of photography that completely changes the whole historical ball game.
One of the direct results of the In Living Memory exhibition is a book called Yamakara. It's a book by the Western Heritage Group, which tells the story of Liza Kennedy and the Kiwong mob. The introduction says, this is a book that's been written from the heart, and if you read it with all your heart, you'll find yourself sitting round the campfire with us in Kiwong mob country. And that's exactly how the book works. Photos from the Aborigines Welfare Board are cut together with colourful, contemporary holiday snaps, and the text is a transcript of the conversation that happened around the campfire. A conversation that's been saved
by the publication of these photographs. Debbie Evans was part of the group that produced this book.
The Nyampo group of the Kiwong mob is sort of a little group between two very big groups, between the Barkindji to the west and then Wiradjuri to the south of them. And it's fantastic. So we've been able to publish these old photographs that directly relate to my father's people.
I was amazed with that publication because you've actually cut the black and white images into the contemporary colour photographs and made a photo montage as if the dead are sitting alongside the living.
Yes. And all those horrendous things, you know, all the massacres and all that sort of intergenerational trauma and pain. These old people were strong, and this is who you can be. This is who you really are deep inside. You're not that one that gets drunk and runs amok and goes and, you know, does all those crazy things.
In its most simple form, it is an exhibition, but it's a healing process. It's a cultural process. It's got so much life beyond just being images on a wall. It truly is helping to save and conserve and spread communities of meaning, I think.
From the other side of the world, Elizabeth Edwards couldn't agree more.
Yes, I think these are really, really important kinds of projects. And it comes back to the point about communities of meaning. What, one of the things I'm interested in is how these different communities of meaning actually start changing archival practice and how photographs in archives are actually perceived. Because they are changing categories within archives, and not just in Australia but elsewhere. These kinds of projects are actually changing the practices of archives about, you know, debates about the ownership of images, how images can be used, how they can be accessed, what can be put online and what can't be put online. And I think there is enormous sensitivity across the board now to the different communities of meaning who have claims on archives of all sorts. And I would include my survey photographs within that overall sense of a shifting community of meaning, because the photographs that I've been working on, as I've said, are actually now in local studies libraries being absorbed into completely different histories, particularly street histories and things like that, house histories. I think it's actually a very exciting time for archives because it's actually completely rethinking what they're for and who they're for, and putting in completely new structures to accommodate the different communities of meaning and their demands on collections.
Part of the community of meaning that Steve Roden's brought to bear on his pictures is a poem. He made everything in his collection sit under the heading, "I listen to the wind obliterate my traces."
It's actually an excerpt from a book-length poem by a Swedish writer named Per Lagerkvist. For me, he's one of the most important writers, and a number of people had told me that Per Lagerkvist's poetry was much better than his fiction. And almost none of it was translated into English. And so I found this book in a used bookstore, and I think it's one of the last things he wrote, and it's clearly a long poem about somebody in old age who's going to die. And so I'll just read you a very short part, a little more than what's in the book, but a little short part. "I listen to the wind that obliterates my traces. The wind that remembers nothing, understands nothing, nor cares what it does, but is so lovely to listen to. The soft wind, soft like oblivion. When the new morning breaks, I shall wander further. In the windless dawn, begin my wandering afresh, with my very first step in the wonderfully untouched sand. Far off on blue paths, heads crowned with silver, wander tall forms that no one has beheld. There kings lift their kingly crowns in stones of which glimmers a mystic light. All is morning, and for the first time, eternal morning and sunrise. And there's, I just think it's so wonderful that, again, listening to the Carl Sprague song, you know, the lyrics to this, especially the first part of this poem, compared to that song, the relationship is so interesting because one of them, you know, was basically a cowboy song and one of them was a Nobel Prize writer. So you've got, you know, what most people would consider to be high culture and low culture being completely, you know, disparate when in fact the ideas are very close.
And you've joined them together with the sound of the wind.
Yes.
From the pallid lips of a youth who lay on his dying bed.
And all this dying and living, all this forgetting and remembering, all this making and obliterating of traces can be captured by a mindless machine.
Kodak suggests a give and take Christmas.
Give Kodak gifts for Christmas, take pictures, save the fun, and share your Merry Christmas days with everyone. Give Kodak gifts for Christmas, take all the Christmas cheer, to live again, enjoy again, year after year. Give Kodak gifts for Christmas, take pictures all year through, to give a Kodak gift, the merriest Christmas thing to do.
No, that's not a message from our sponsors, and thank goodness it's not Christmas. Today's program was brought to you by Hindsight here on RN. You heard from Elizabeth Edwards, Susan Charlton, Debbie Evans, Steve Roden, and in the darkroom, Alex Syndicus. Lynn Gallagher was the producer today, and Melissa May, the sound engineer. In case you're interested in following these ideas further, there's a Dark Matter Photo History Symposium coming up at the Art Gallery of New South Wales on the 12th of April. It's about how photographic objects and their subjects can be reinterpreted across time, and we'll put up a link on our website. Next week, though, remembering the life and the stories of the late Ross McInerney. Ross lived with his wife, the photographer Olive Cotton, on a small farm in country New South Wales. His stories of life on the land and the folk history of his area give us a window into a way of life in rural Australia that has long disappeared.
Ben Hall operated around here, Kurrawatta, Canoundra and places like that. And my grandfather being pretty isolated here, I think he would have helped them too. It was an Irish thing. See, these bush rangers, I used to call them bush strangers when I was little, they were fairly generous to people that helped them. They didn't have much use for the money that they stole. They wouldn't, because they couldn't mix. They were fugitives.
Ross McInerney and his local bush rangers in Spring Forest. That's next week on Hindsight. I'm Lorena Allam. Thanks for listening today. My thanks also to Joe Wallace. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon here on RN.
It was the fire that wouldn't go out.
We've just witnessed three enormous explosions. Now we're seeing what is probably 50-foot high flames.
And left a town in utter confusion.
I can't breathe. We can't go on like this.
The Hazelwood Mine fire burned for more than a month, covering thousands in a toxic plume.
The response we're getting from our government feels like the American government's response to Hurricane Katrina.
You can download this background briefing from the RN website.